Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 26 of the Assorted Calibers podcast. The Second Amendment podcast is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me, as always, is my hostess, Erin Paulette. How are you doing, Erin?
I am staring at my nice, shiny Second Amendment Foundation Defender of Liberty Award, and it looks spectacular on my desk.
Yes, this is no leg lamp here. This is an actual major award.
Oh, geez. Leg lamp.
I gotta say, Erin, you had to have known about the merger of Operation Blazing Sword and Pink Pistols long before any of us did. So have you got, like, I haven't gotten over it yet. Like, I'm still like, oh man, yeah. Wow. Has the scope of your phenomenal cosmic powers, like, you know, caught up to you?
No, not yet. I have actually been busy dealing with growing pains, talking on the Pink Pistols Facebook page, bringing people up to speed, telling them, it's okay, I'm not going to be a dictator, here's just some general guidelines, here's what it means for you, it's going to be all right, answering all sorts of questions. And I've been very busy doing that.
Because overall, you're not demanding that much more. They're from the individual chapters, are you? It's more of the now Pink Pistols has a national umbrella that they could seek out to help themselves and help others.
Yes, I'm not demanding anything new. I am, however, reiterating the previous request from Gwen Patton that we try to be as inclusive as possible, which means no splintering off into increasingly fractious and contentious political causes. Pink Pistols, just like Operation Blazing Sword, needs to be single issue only. Mm-hmm. And some people, well, what exactly does that mean? Well, how do we then spread the word if we aren't doing things in political marches? And so I'm having to give guidelines. It's like, look, I'm not your mom. I'm not going to tell you that you can't go to, say, a women's march or a protest. I just ask that you don't do it waving Pink Pistol banners, wearing Pink Pistol t-shirts, because what's going to happen is the media will see it and they will say, oh, look, here are members of the Pink Pistols at this anti-Trump march or at this confirmed Kavanaugh march. Mm-hmm. And they're going to say that clearly the Pink Pistols support this political cause, and that's going to turn people off. I want to be a big tent, and so I don't want us to be super liberal because I want to bring in conservatives. I don't want us to be super conservative because I want to bring in liberals. And so by not attaching our name to missions that aren't ours, I think we can do that. And so if people believe in these causes, by all means, do it. Just do it on your own time as a private citizen. And I suppose if you wanted to do a little bit of outreach, someone could wear a very subtle piece of flair like a pin or a ribbon or things like that and help spread the word. But it's just important to me that they be there not as representatives of a chapter because I don't want us to get pulled into this BS. And so I was explaining that to people and they needed some examples. And some people were saying, well, how do we get the word out? And I'm saying there's all sorts of examples of getting the word out that aren't political. Go to the local LGBTQ center and leave some flyers if they'll let you. You've got business cards. Leave them at coffee shops. Put stuff up on bulletin boards, at libraries, at local clubs, things like that. Like state fairs, pride festivals. That's a good one. Block parties, just all sorts of things that aren't specifically political, but where people are gathering, you can say, hey, we're this organization. Have you heard about us? Please join us. That sort of thing.
Or, yeah, places like, you know, state fairs, which are the local candidate for Senate might be there. I mean, I know I saw a lot of political booths. I was at our state fair this weekend. And I saw a lot of political booths and all that. But again, it's nonpartisan. There's some on this side. There's some on that side. So you can't pigeonhole them with that.
Exactly. And that's really what I'm concerned about. I don't want the press to spin us as being pro this or anti that, because that could end up driving people away. And we want to be as welcoming and inclusive as possible.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of the same feeling I've got towards this podcast is, I mean, we've got our own political views and this is a political podcast by nature, but I don't want it to be another, I'm more of a libertarian type guy and there's a ton of libertarian Second Amendment podcasts. There's a ton of conservative Second Amendment podcasts, and we don't really need to be another one of those. And I'd like it to be just political in the sense that the Second Amendment is politics, and let's focus on that, and let's be pro Second Amendment.
Yeah, you're political by being pro Second Amendment, but you aren't partisan.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, yeah, that's really what I've been up to this past week, just doing a lot of, it's not even damage control, just people want to know what my policies are. And I'm basically restating the old policies, but, you know, here's what you need to know. And so that's what I've been doing there. I got a really, really great article written about, well, me, us, both. Because, I mean, they were talking about me, but they also talked about Operation Blazing Sword merging into Pink Pistols. And it was on guns.com. And it's just a really lovely article. And I am impressed by the very kind comments. And so either the readers of guns.com are very fine human beings, or there is a moderator working overtime to remove all the nasty little trolls whose only purpose is to say crappy things. But either way, it's a great article. I love everything that's been said about them. So thank you.
You've also done a bunch of other interviews, haven't you? And speaking of arrangements?
Well, while I was at GRPC, I was actually interviewed twice, both by elements of Vice News. One of them was right after the Concealed Carry Fashion Show. They were doing little interviews for each of the models. And I actually got a very nice compliment from one of the cameramen there. Weird, can you play that clip for me?
Honestly, I'll go on record saying this. I've met thousands of people in my life. You're probably one of the most interesting people I've ever met. That is a f-ing real thing, and I'll say that to anybody.
Really?
That's really serious. I'm so glad that I got to meet you.
Wow. I mean, obviously, you weren't set up to be recording that in high def, but I think we get the gist of it.
Yeah, so that was really cool. And then the next day, no, wait, it was actually the same day, I think. Ah, everything's fuzzy. But I actually was interviewed by Tess Owens of another form of Vice Media, whatever. And she was just talking about gun culture. And, you know, I talked to her for like 45 minutes to an hour. I think I got a couple lines in the article, which just seems to be how this works. Because I remember way back in 2016, when I was interviewed by BBC, we shot for 30 minutes or so. We talked for an hour. I got maybe a few minutes in the actual special itself. So most of what's said in an interview goes on the cutting room floor, essentially. I'm always nervous whenever I do interviews like this, because I represent two communities. And a regular person going on an interview could maybe just embarrass themselves. Weird, if you went on an interview, you could maybe, I doubt it, but it's theoretically possible that you could embarrass the gun community. I could embarrass both, and I am really, really aware of that, and I don't want to accidentally throw either one under the bus, and I'm very, very nervous. And so anytime I have one of these interviews and I look at the published result, I just go, oh, thank God I didn't screw up, is really what it comes down to. And so I got a few good lines. I think one of the takeaway lines was when I was talking about how gun owners were saying to LGBTQ people, your life has value. It is inherently precious and we want you to defend that. And that is a sentiment I can't see repeated enough. And so that was great. If nothing else about me is quoted, I want that to be quoted. And that was cool. And so that was GRPC weekend. And then, well, I got back. I tried to recover. And then on Thursday, I had to drive down to Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton, which is about 3.5 to 4 hours away from me. And so, just pro tip here. If you are going away for a weekend for a convention, give yourself a full week of buffer time. I was still jet lagged by the time I drove down there. And this was me not suffering from con crud. If I had actually caught the crud like so many people did, I would have been even more miserable, or possibly not able to talk, feeling bad, infecting other people. So I'm glad that didn't happen. But just pro tip, yeah, give yourself a week or so between these things. So I drove down, and I was invited by a professor of the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice. And he wanted me to give a presentation on how LGBTQ doesn't mean victim. And I'm going to be honest here, I didn't really have a speech prepared because I was so busy working on GRPC that I kind of let it go by the wayside. And I just thought, well, you know, I'll be able to work on it when I come back. And no, I didn't. I was tired. I was trying to catch up. And so when I got down there, I just sort of said, okay, I guess I'm just going to fake this. And this is going to sound like bragging, and maybe it is. I don't intend it to be. But I feel like I leveled up in Bard because I was able to pull a 45-minute presentation pretty much out of my rear end, and I think it was a good one. Because a lot of these things I've just said enough times that it's almost modular. I just need a few notes to link it all together.
Well, I've finally seen your AmCon speech, and yeah, that one you totally did not expect to be giving an individual speech for. And yeah, if it wasn't for the fact that you told anyone who would willing to listen that, oh, I wasn't prepared for this at all, like, yeah, no one would have known you weren't prepared for it. That was a beautiful speech.
Oh, thank you. So I actually had a recorder with me, the same recorder that I had for the Vice interview, actually, and I had it running while I was speaking at FAU, and I've got that up on my Patreon, my personal Patreon, so any of my patrons can listen to it, because this stuff is gold, folks. I'm not going to give it away for free, but I hope you'll take a listen. And, you know, most of the students there, I'm not really sure how many we had. I'm going to say we had no more than 30, and most of them were there for extra credit. But I am happy to say that they all seemed attentive, and I got some really good questions during the question and answer period. The professor who invited me, he specifically reached out to the LGBTQ club on campus, and they would have nothing to do with him. They would not answer. And he actually got irritated that they wouldn't give him the time of day. And I don't know what's happened, but apparently he was going to have a nice talk with their faculty advisor under the whole, you know, if someone from faculty wants to talk to you, you do not brush them off. Mm. So no one from that side of things came to listen. But interestingly enough, someone from the Young Republicans on campus came, and he was the only one in the front row, just right there in front of me, and actually paying attention. And I picked on him a little bit because he was there. Not in a bad way, but just anytime I need an example, it's like, oh, you're right there. He was a really good sport about it. So it was just really interesting that the Young Republicans, who are allegedly anti-gay, was right there and very attentive, but no one from the queer community would give me the time of day.
Did you end up speaking with this guy from the Young Republicans?
A little bit. After I gave the presentation, I told people, I know that there are some folks who have some questions to ask, but they maybe don't feel comfortable asking them in front of everyone else. So you can come up to me and talk to me in person. And I don't think the guy was shy, but he just had that opportunity and he wanted to talk to me about stuff. So had a really great conversation there that actually didn't get caught on the recorder. The other thing that was interesting was someone brought up the question of Australian-style confiscation. And I actually had the opportunity to drop a bomb because I said the victims of the Monash University massacre beg to differ. And there was a long silence. And I go, oh, you don't know about that, do you? And the guy said, no, you're not laughing.
No,
you,
I'm not.
You don't know what I'm talking about.
I'm not familiar with that one either.
Okay. So the really short version is, despite Australia confiscating a lot of weapons, there have still been mass killings
Absolutely.
Since then. And Monash University was one of the biggest. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't entirely a mic drop moment, but it was pretty cool. It was just so cool because someone was all, but what about Australia? Aren't they doing it right? It's like, oh, so you don't know about this mass killing at a school? Mm-hmm. No, I don't. Maybe you should. And then the professor chimed in and says, yeah, I've actually got a list. There are about 7 of these.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and also I got to say, like, I'm amazed at how many mass murder arsons there are in Australia. Like it's a classification all on its own. Like it's got its own Wikipedia page of mass, you know, intentional arsons that for murder in Australia. And just something that we don't even like hear about here. Like that's just not a thing that happens.
Wow. So are we talking like family homes or are we talking like apartment buildings?
Like there's one where a guy burned down a hospital.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. No, there's, yeah. There's all of those things, family homes, apartment buildings, hospitals, municipal buildings. It's been a little while since I've actually looked at the stats since I've done an audio fisc on Australia. So, I'm not 100% sure on all of those, but I know there was one where I don't think it was a whole hospital was burned down, but I believe a wing was immolated with some sort of incendiary device.
Oh, that's terrible.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
So enough about me, but on the topic of GRPC, I introduced you to an amazing person there, didn't I?
You absolutely did. We didn't get a chance to talk at GRPC too long. You introduced me to her just before the break was over, but it was Laura Carno, and she's of Faster Colorado, and she also took a part in the Colorado recall election that was 2013. And I'm just like, oh yeah, we've got to talk more. So in between bouts of my con crud, I was actually quite sick last week. We sat down and we did some interviews. And so I would love to play part one of the Laura Carno interview.
Dear audience, I didn't tell him to write this. He wrote this.
Yes, I definitely said, Aaron told me I definitely need to interview her. And Aaron is rarely wrong about such things. And I think you'll soon all agree.
Aww.
So at the Gun Rights Policy Conference, I had the pleasure of meeting Laura Carno. She is the executive director of Faster Colorado and a political coordinator. And I did not hear your speech at AmCon, but Aaron said that it absolutely blew her mind and that I needed to have you on the show.
Well, and here we are. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for coming on. So you wanted to start off talking about Faster Colorado.
Sure. And Faster Colorado is a training program for school staff members who are armed on campus. And we brought it out to Colorado in 2017 from Ohio. And we sort of look at Ohio, the organization called Faster Saves Lives. We look at them as sort of the mothership. They conceived of this idea of training armed school staff in a very organized way in the days after Sandy Hook. And since then, they've trained over 1,600 school staffers, mostly in Ohio, but a few folks have come from out of state as well to get trained. And in 2017, Colorado became the first state to fully implement a Faster program. And by the end of this year, we'll have trained, gosh, probably 125 folks. We've had to add some classes this year because of the demand here in Colorado.
So now FASTER, that's actually an acronym, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an acronym, and it stands for Faculty Administrator Safety Training and Emergency Response. And you know, don't have to remember it beyond that it actually stands for something. What I love about the name FASTER is it reminds us how precious those moments are when, God forbid, the worst happens on one of our kids' campuses, and that the faster you stop the killer and the faster you stop the bleeding, the fewer people die. And so I love that aside from it being an acronym, there's some urgency in that word that that reminds us that we have to act quickly, or people are going to lose their lives.
Yeah, I think that brings to mind the tragedy in Parkland, where the police failed to clear the scene in any major speed and people's lives were lost just from lack of medical attention, let alone the damage done by the shooter. But even then, I mean, the old bumper sticker saying goes that, you know, when moments count, police are minutes away.
Right.
And so absolutely agree with that idea, is that when danger happens, the closer somebody who can help you is, the better.
Right. And if that person happens to be a school resource officer, which are uniformed, armed, sworn members of local law enforcement, if that person is right there and he or she can stop it, that's great. But the problem comes where these bad people who are killing students in these mass killing events, they on purpose would never start what they're doing right in front of an armed and uniformed member of law enforcement, because sadly we know a lot about these people and they want to rack up maximum body count. So of course they're not going to start it in front of a school resource officer, which is where ordinary school staffers carrying concealed comes in. They don't know who's armed and who's not armed, and they can potentially be there more quickly.
Or also, just to be a little bit more to the point, is a lot of these shooters have left manifestos and they've openly stated that they're very concerned about when the good guys with guns show up. Part of me really, really wants to hope, it may not be all the time, but really wants to hope that if just your school system says, yeah, we're not going to say how many we've got, we're not going to say who's got, but we are going to say that there is armed staff that is not uniformed law enforcement on board, that might really put a damper on a lot of the plans of these spree killers.
Right. And so there's a deterrent effect. And I think that even if you're in a school that isn't armed, just the fact that Ohio has rolled out this really big program, does that keep people from going into any Ohio school because they don't know, is this one of the armed ones? Is it not one of the armed ones? So there definitely are a lot of deterrent effects to those. Some of them you'll never know. Did it stop something here or not? But there certainly is a deterrent effect of armed citizens everywhere. And, you know, schools are just another place in the everywhere.
So what kind of training is done by Faster Colorado?
Yeah, so it's very intensive training. So it's a 3-day training. We are at 28 hours over 3 days. We work them pretty hard. Before we get to the firearms, I'll tell you about the things that aren't firearms because they don't really get a lot of mention. Number one is the mindset training. And what that means is that if you are a school staffer who knows the kid, that when we see that many of these things happen with students or former students, so you know this person and you didn't get into teaching or coaching or whatever your profession is in the school. You didn't get into that profession like a cop does, knowing that they might have to be faced with this. So there's a mindset component that you might have to stop somebody you know from killing other people you know. And it's a very emotional first half of day one, but we need to get them through that because it needs to really sink in what they're signing up for. They know when they raise their hand and volunteer what they're signing up for, but we need to make it really, really very clear. And it starts the class with, this is really very, very serious. This isn't just a firearms training class. And then the second part that doesn't get a whole lot of attention is that medical training that you mentioned, that lots of people could die just from injuries. So in Sandy Hook, it took medics 45 minutes to be cleared to enter the building. And we'll never know the answer to the question, but how many people could have been saved? Were there medically trained people already on the inside? Were there tourniquets already on the inside? So we take them through a very gory would be probably the right way to position it, part of the class that shows them what these injuries look like and how you stop them. It's called TCCC, Tactical Combat Casualty Care. And it's, if you think about it, very similar to frontline military medical training. If you're not a medic in the military, but you are trained on how to keep your buddy alive until you can get to an actual medic to save his or her life. So it's the tourniquets and chest seals and compression bandages and that sort of thing. And we also give them a medical kit, a trauma kit, to go back to their school with. So if a school trains five people, they go back with five trauma kits that can be placed strategically throughout the school. And then, of course, there's very advanced firearm skills. This is not a beginner course by any stretch. And they have to pass a test at the very end of it that actually exceeds in Colorado the test that Colorado law enforcement passes when they leave the academy in that one narrow skill of handgun proficiency. And in Ohio, it's a very similar thing, but they have the Ohio version of that. So our folks leave being more proficient than law enforcement when they leave the academy in that one narrow skill. Essentially, we take the test, add a couple of shots to it, and still require that they pass it at 100%. So it's very intense. We get amazing feedback at the end of class on how this training changed their life and how seriously they take the role they just volunteered for.
Well, that's awesome. And also, I got to just say, for things like the tourniquets and things like that, I mean, I know in my high school, we never had any violent incident whatsoever, but there was a kid whose life was saved by a teacher who had first aid training. He ended up using a t-shirt for a tourniquet, but the kid ended up, he was running down the hall and put his arm through a glass door and nicked an artery, and his life was saved because of that. So just because this is in the guise of active shooters doesn't mean that these things don't have other applications.
Yeah, absolutely. And if your school has a wood shop, you better have tourniquets, you know? And so here's what's interesting is that we hear from schools who say, well, we're going to have five armed defenders, but we have 10 or 15 or 20 other people who want to be part of the solution if the worst possible thing happens, but they don't want to be the armed person. Can they go through just medical training? And a lot of schools are very interested in having multiple additional staff members medically trained, because we see in these situations that that's a huge need. And not everybody wants to be an armed person. That's okay. But they want to be part of the solution and want to be part of the response team. And so having them medically trained is a great idea.
Yeah, that is an absolutely great idea. Especially one of the talking points used by our opponents is that, oh, we're, you know, arming teachers, we're handing out guns to teachers. And no, we don't want to give a gun to a teacher that doesn't want one. That's the last thing that we want. And you know, the last thing that we want as Second Amendment advocates is mandatory gun ownership. No, it's right. You have the freedom to own, just like the First Amendment also has the right to remain silent in the Miranda rights.
Exactly. Yeah. And thanks for bringing that up, because we do hear very frequently in the national discussion on this that we are arming teachers as if there is a proactive thing that we are doing. We are bringing guns to teachers, and we're not doing that at all. And neither are school boards for the most part. There are a few school boards who say we're going to have an armed staff policy and we are going to purchase firearms for the school staff. That's kind of a rarity in what we're seeing here in Colorado. For the most part, these folks who are volunteering to be armed on campus, they are doing that because they are significantly comfortable with the idea already, because they are already armed outside of school. They have made that decision in their lives to be the defender in their family, to defend their children, their spouse, if need be, with a firearm. So if you look at it a different way, our society says law-abiding people can be armed unless you're in this particular building. And so what we're saying is don't disarm them when they go to work if they have already made that choice. So it's really not what you hear about in the kind of establishment media about arming teachers. It's just allowing those defenders to remain defenders when they go to work.
Yeah, to dovetail it all back together, really, you want to make schools as safe as movie theaters, shopping malls, grocery stores, the places that have put no restrictions whatsoever. If you can lawfully carry here, you can lawfully carry at home, you can lawfully carry here, you can lawfully carry there. And those places don't see the kind of attacks that our schools do.
Right. And then the other thing that I'll mention too is most of the early adopters of this policy are rural schools, because they do the math very quickly and they say, gosh, we're 30 minutes or 45 minutes away from law enforcement. They're also the smallest and least funded schools typically. And so we also raise private money so that no school should go without this great training because of lack of budget. So, and this is another thing that we brought from Ohio, where they have been raising private money for 6 years. So we're doing that same thing here in Colorado. So 80%+ of our participants go through at zero cost to the employee, the school, or the district. So that's another benefit here in Colorado to those school staffers, is they never have to pick between, well, I want to be armed, but I can't afford the training. They can be authorized by their school and have access to this world-class training.
Oh, that's awesome. So if somebody's with a Colorado school district, how do they contact FASTR?
Yeah, so they can go to fastercolorado.com to find out what we're doing here in Colorado. They can contact me there as well. If folks are outside of Colorado and want more information on how to bring this to their state, talk to the folks in Ohio, and their website is fastersaveslives.org, and they are helping lots of states bring this to their own state as well.
Well, that's awesome. And links to that will be in the show notes. Thank you so much, Laura, for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Appreciate your interest.
Ah, she's just so amazing. I'm going to have to look into bringing FASTR to Florida. I think the time is right for that, given just the ridiculous amount of training that armed school teachers are required to have here. And heck, even if they don't get the firearms training, just the medical training alone would be not just great, but I think almost essential. I honestly don't know why school teachers aren't given trauma training, considering all the stuff that could go wrong.
I think at some schools they are. I mentioned in the interview about the kid that slashed an artery going through a glass door. And I know that teacher had first aid training for that, but we don't have any, there was no trauma kits. Like I said, he just improvised a tourniquet to stop the bleeding and save this kid's life.
Yeah. And like she said, if anyone has shop class, oh my God, yeah. Bandsaws. Yeah. Yeah. You really, really need tourniquets and pressure bandages and all that stuff.
I hadn't even thought about the shop classes to realize, oh yeah, that is a good place to lop off a body part.
Well, for certain values of good, yeah.
So I think by now we are all completely overloaded listening to the Kavanaugh hearings, talking about all this allegations of sexual assault and allegations of heavy drinking and all of this stuff. Why don't we talk about Kavanaugh, but instead talk about his firearms record with this NPR feature that I found. So to start off this weird audio Fisk, I'll give you a little inside baseball on how you get the audio I Fisk. Step 1, subscribe to all the anti-gun groups and social media pages and read their web pages. Step 2, go to npr.org and type guns into the search bar. That's where this week's Fisk came from. The news article is on the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court seat vacated by Justice Kennedy. Specifically, this story is talking about his stance on, you guessed it, guns.
In the battle over the Supreme Court nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh, the usual suspects are lining up in support and in opposition. But at the grassroots level, there is one new entry nervously eyeing the Kavanaugh nomination. It is March for Our Lives, started by high school students in Parkland, Florida after the shooting there, and aimed ultimately at enacting more effective gun regulations.
So by the usual suspects, they mean that this is an overall partisan split. So much that some left-leaning groups had already written up the opposition statements before President Trump had even announced that Judge Kavanaugh was the nominee. Still, it dives into the first big lie with the statements by March for Our Lives. March for Our Lives is a division of Everytown for Gun Safety. Everytown is simply Michael Bloomberg's Mayors Against Illegal Guns political action group renamed. And like Moms Demand Action, March for Our Lives is simply another brand owned and wholly controlled by Michael Bloomberg. The only thing new is the branding. Everything else is the same as it's always been.
Kavanaugh's basically the roadblock to anything we want happening.
18-year-old Charlie Mirsky is the political director of March for Our Lives.
Do you really think Michael Bloomberg is going to leave one of his brands in the hands of an 18-year-old kid? No. Like Shannon Watts of Moms Demand Action, he is a figurehead selected for optics to deliver Michael Bloomberg's anti-gun message. And given that Michael Bloomberg has never shown any opposition to any gun control laws presented, either in the United States or abroad, including mass confiscation or the draconian policies he oversaw as mayor of New York City, I would hope any justice in any court would be opposed to Michael Bloomberg's agenda.
We believe that if we got anything passed, he could declare it unconstitutional, and he really could just block anything we want from staying in place.
I would argue that he could make that declaration, because the core of any anti-gun agenda is anti-Second Amendment. This is why I applaud the anti-gunners who demand we repeal the Second Amendment, because at least they're being honest. Unlike the corporate anti-gun lobby who can't think of a gun they wouldn't like to see banned, but support our Second Amendment rights.
Of course, Kavanaugh could not do that by himself, but Second Amendment scholars on the right and left agree he could tilt the court decidedly against gun regulations.
Which is a sad thing to say, as many of the other judges don't think the Second Amendment means what it says. I do wish we lived in a world where judges would interpret the law as written, rather than bend the law to their political views.
UCLA law professor Adam Winkler has written extensively about gun control.
Kavanaugh believes in a very vigorous Second Amendment right to bear arms and thinks there's little room for constitutionally permissible gun control.
I would argue that our founding fathers felt the same way when they took time to write the Second Amendment and made it second only to the freedom of press, speech, and worship. Again, if you support the agenda of the corporate anti-gun lobby, then you really should be working to get that amendment out of your way first.
In 2008, the court, for the first time, declared that the Second Amendment right to bear arms is an individual right. The vote was 5-4, with Justice Anthony Kennedy casting the deciding fifth vote.
To be fair, the Heller decision was 7-0 on the individual right to keep and bear arms. The whole collective right argument is just a logical contortion that the anti-gunners came up with to somehow claim that they support the Second Amendment, but also want to ban all the guns. Of course, the dissent from the Heller case claims that yes, you have an individual right to keep and bear arms, but banning guns and demanding the few guns you can have be inoperable at all times is reasonable. It's so sad that we have federal judges that not only think this, but will write it on a public document.
The decision was written by Justice Antonin Scalia, a gun enthusiast, but it included limiting language, explicitly endorsing some regulations as constitutional. For instance, laws barring felons or those with a history of mental illness from owning guns. It is widely believed that much of the limiting language in the decision was added at the insistence of Justice Kennedy.
I don't know about how Kennedy was involved, but despite the fact that I disagree with much of the limiting language in Heller, I will admit that our rights weren't reduced to today's levels overnight. So the idea that we could erase 60 to 100 years of unconstitutional gun control laws in one day is a bit extreme. I personally think the limiting language was put in to keep the scope of Heller sufficiently narrow to cover the complaints of the case. In this case, Dick Heller requesting to bring a revolver into the District of Columbia. He was not requesting a carry permit, he was not bringing in a machine gun, or even an AR-15. So the court left those questions up to a future court case.
In 2011, disagreeing with two conservative colleagues, he wrote a 52-page dissent from a decision that upheld a D.C. ban on assault weapons and magazines of more than 10 rounds, plus broad registration requirements.
I want to know what the problem with those other judges were. Have you ever seen those labels that say, "Warning, this product contains chemicals known to the state of California to cause cancer, birth defects, and other reproductive harm"? That's a law in California called Proposition 65. And what makes it really funny is it's not like California has less cancer or birth defects than any of the other 49 states. Same can be said about the handful of anti-gun states that have these outrageous gun laws. All the other states seem to be doing just fine letting their citizens buy whatever guns they want and load as much ammo as they want into them and carry them, sometimes even without a permit. It's not like DC is a particularly safe place, unlike, say, New Hampshire. I understand that DC is very different from New Hampshire. But certainly DC's insane gun laws aren't helping.
Kavanaugh argued that the right to bear arms is a fundamental right that can be limited only in the narrowest of circumstances. A ban on a class of arms is not an incidental regulation, he wrote. It is equivalent to a ban on a category of speech. Moreover, he said, it is not for judges to weigh public safety in evaluating whether a gun law is constitutional. Weapons should be permissible, he said, if they are in common use today and have not been traditionally banned.
Or to quote Justice Thomas on the Voice Scene versus United States case, where the prohibition of people with misdemeanor convictions of domestic violence for owning guns was called into question, give me another area where a misdemeanor violation suspends a constitutional right. It's a very interesting argument. Why is the Second Amendment treated so differently from every other amendment on the Bill of Rights? I would contend that it shouldn't be.
One of the things that's most worrisome to gun control advocates is that Judge Kavanaugh believes only long-standing gun restrictions are constitutionally permissible, which suggests that novel, innovative ways to solve gun violence problems would not be acceptable in Judge Kavanaugh's view.
What novel gun control ideas are there? And when has it ever been asked to prove if these laws provide any safety for the sacrifice of freedom? Ben Franklin once said, "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." Except that violent crime never goes down in the wake of more restrictive gun control. So we are trading liberty for nothing when we allow the anti-gunners to win. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
So, I thought about the question you asked in that segment, why is the Second Amendment treated differently from all other rights? And I may not have the answer, but I have an answer. It's the only right that talks about possessing a physical object. The First Amendment says freedom of the press, not freedom to own and operate a printing press. And so I wonder if the Second Amendment had said, for example, the right of the people to defend themselves by any means shall not be infringed, we would probably be having a much different argument today.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, to be fair, the printing press thing was very much something that was restricted. And you certainly have instances where printing presses were restricted in like places like Europe at the time. But I think by the time the Bill of Rights was being drafted, I think that had been learned to be as gauche as it was, that no, we're not going to work hard to control the means to disseminate information in print to the people. So I really think it's more of just the issue that the Second Amendment really is, it was written by a bunch of people who had just overthrown their government, a tyrannical government. And I think it's the one amendment that very much is a, no, we are not going to submit to a tyrannical government. And we and the people are the ultimate linchpin in any of the checks and balances of government, I think. And now that we get more and more encroaching government, I think that's where the threat comes, is that the Second Amendment really is the most terrifying of all the amendments to the people that have zero respect for the Bill of Rights anyway.
Well, possibly. I don't know. I like my answer.
Yeah.
Of course, doesn't mean you're wrong.
No.
David is Jewish, and on Yom Kippur, it's traditional to think about the past. In this segment of Gun Lovers and Other Strangers, he reflects on some of his favorite firearms and how he got them.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. By the time you hear this segment, the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur will have passed a few weeks ago. Yom Kippur, also known as the Day of Atonement, is the end of what are called the High Holy Days, starting with Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. On Yom Kippur, tradition is to reflect over the past year and seek forgiveness from those against whom we've transgressed. As tends to happen, when I reflect over the past, my mind doesn't stop with the last year. In keeping with the spirit of my segment, follow along as I reflect on my history with firearms. My first hands-on exposure to firearms was probably in summer camp when I was about 7 years old. We were taught the basics on old single-shot, bolt-action, 22-rimfire rifles. That was actually one of the only things I looked forward to about summer camp. Not being good at sports and having a preference for reading didn't exactly make me popular. Other than summer camp, firearms were not something I had access to as a youngster. As I've mentioned, I grew up in Manhattan, where legally owned firearms are pretty scarce. However, my father and I would watch Western and military-themed movies together. One in particular that I have fond memories of was the documentary series The World at War, narrated by Sir Laurence Olivier. My father also had the entire collection of Time Life World War II books, and I would spend hours poring over them. When I was around 12 years old, my father took me to Coney Island, and among other things, we tried our hand at the shooting gallery. This was back in the day when they still had actual 22 rimfire rifles there. We had a great time making the steel targets ring. My next experience with firearms probably didn't occur until after I moved to Albany in the 80s. One of my friends had an old Marlin Model 60 that we would take out to the woods for plinking on occasion. After that, I applied for my pistol license when I turned 21, and the Albany judge denied my application because, as he stated in his letter, he didn't think I needed one. I happen to agree, but New York state law was and is pretty specific about needing a pistol license to buy a handgun. So, I took the money I'd saved up for my first pistol and bought my first rifle instead. A Marlin Model 336 in 30-30 Winchester. I still have that rifle and wouldn't think of letting it go. That rifle was followed within a few years by a Ruger 10-22 and a Mosberg 500 12-gauge. I slowly built my collection of long guns over the following years. It wasn't until after I met the woman who would become my wife that I applied for my pistol license again. This time, I was approved, and my license actually arrived in the mail on my birthday. I was so happy, and happier still that I could share it with her. My first handgun purchase probably won't be too much of a surprise. I bought a reproduction single-action army revolver by Uberti. Yes, I finally got my cowboy gun. This was followed pretty closely by a Springfield USGI-style 1911 in 45 ACP. Just like the ones carried by the American soldiers in the movies my father and I watched together. My long gun collecting slowed down as I focused more on handguns. My pistol collection has several areas of focus. Older Smith & Wesson revolvers is one, World War II military handguns or reproductions is another, and vintage pocket pistols is the third. When an anti-gun person accuses me of liking guns because I'm compensating for something, I can sometimes throw them off by asking, if that's the case, why do I collect pocket pistols? They never quite seem to know how to react to that question. In addition to the previously mentioned categories, I also have a random selection of handguns that don't really fit into any category, other than they interested me at the time or it was too good a deal to pass up. That's how I wound up with a Heckler & Koch P7 Squeezecocker, a Star BM 9mm, a Beretta Model 84 and 380 ACP, amongst others. I could tell a story about each firearm in my collection, when I bought it, where I found it, and likely some interesting historical, cultural, or technical tidbit. Because not only do I collect firearms, I also collect firearm books. Some newer, others vintage. One of the prizes of my firearms book collection is a near-complete set of shooter's Bibles from the 1930s through the 20-teens. Not only are these old catalogs a great window into the past, but on more than one occasion they've helped me share some knowledge with a fellow firearms enthusiast. Those are some of my firearms-related recollections. I'm glad I could share them with you. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
So, Weird, I know that you're a big handgun nut. You love handguns over any other sort of firearms. You would go nuts over David's collection. He has an entire safe full of nothing but pistols. And I don't mean a little safe. I mean one of those 6 foot tall, 3 or 4 feet wide, big ass safes full of pistols.
Ugh. Yeah, no, that was actually one of the things I was thinking when he was talking about his handgun collection is the, oh man, you collect pocket pistols too? Oh God, I would love to see this collection. and again, also, I do love of the fact of the, oh no, I've got like so many snub-nosed revolvers and pocket pistols. And I mean, I've got like one of the tiniest 45 ACPs available on the market, the Kar PM45. That's one of my standard carry guns. And if I'm compensating for something, why do I work so hard to get the gun so little?
I'm actually trying to remember which of his guns impressed me the most. And it's been over a year and he showed me so many. The one that stands out most in my memory, it's not the coolest, but it's the one that I remember, is he has the pistol that the Megatron toy transformed into.
I've specifically had to Walther P38 or a Walther P1, depending on which variant you're getting. But I specifically bought one, and its name is Megatron. There was somebody who actually got one that was in beat up condition and Cerakoted it to look just like Megatron. Even put the purple Decepticon logo on the slide. But I was also impressed that, I mean, I shot my first gun at 19 and I really didn't have much experience at all. Like, the closest I've got is my great grandfather lived way out in the country. He lived in Bridgeton, Maine, and he had a 22 rifle tucked behind the back door that was literally just for shooting varmints. If there were raccoons getting into the garbage or squirrels getting into his bird feeder, he was going to take care of that with that rifle. And so there was a 22 rifle and there was an ashtray. He had quit smoking long before I was born. But of course, just because you quit smoking doesn't mean you get rid of your prodigious collection of beautiful crystal ashtrays that you really can't find anymore. That was filled with 22 shells, so he just grabbed one and stuff it in the single shot 22 that he had. And that would also be, we would occasionally go on quote unquote bear hunts where it was just us walking through the woods and I would see various imagined animals that needed to be shot, and I would have that 22, and I didn't even realize it was actually a real gun. I just was like, yeah, this isn't really much of a toy. It's way too heavy and it doesn't go click when you pull the trigger. But that's pretty much the extent of my firearms knowledge all the way up until I was 19 and a buddy said, hey, you want to go shooting? Yeah, I do want to go shooting. And so I'm amazed that given that I was in Maine, a super duper gun friendly place where, oh yeah, no, there were lots of people that had guns. I mean, there was a ton of the, oh yeah, no, you go over to somebody's house and there's a rifle hanging up on a wall, or, you know, a little case filled with guns somewhere in the house. But yeah, it was one of those. That's just standard scenery. But yet, yeah, there in New York. Oh, went to Coney Island. It was actually shooting the rimfire in the shooting galleries. That's awesome.
Yeah, I was actually surprised to learn that at these various fairs or whatever, they actually use live ammunition. That surprised me.
Well, that's where the 22 CB caps come from. I don't know if you've got much experience with those. But
no, I don't know what you're talking about.
So a 22 CB cap is like the ultimate of these. You get the 22 shorts and the, you know, 22 longs and the 22 long rifle. They're all slightly smaller.
Wait, are these the ones that it's basically no gunpowder, is just fired by the primer?
Exactly. It is literally just a primer with a very lightweight 22 bullet stuck onto it.
Yes. I haven't heard them called that. I've heard them called something else. When I went up to the bidet shoot in Tennessee about, oh my god, I think it was 5 years ago. This was the one where Oddball freehanded a 50 caliber mm-hmm. rifle. I think it was an AR-50. A friend of mine, Eric Dubb, he actually had I don't remember the model, I'm sorry, but it was a lovely Western-looking lever action rifle in 22, and he had loaded with those things, and the sound of the hammer falling or the lever working the action was actually louder than the report of the round firing. It's just no recoil at all. I'm going, did it actually fire? Because I didn't hear anything.
And given that it was a tubular magazine, he probably fit about 1,000 of them in there.
Oh, yeah. I don't know how many, but there were a bunch. It was just, God, am I fighting? Well, yeah, I just hit, so okay. It's just really weird. I mean, it felt like less than a toy, because a toy would actually give you that little click feedback. And, of course, I had the earmuffs on, and it was just, is this thing working? Yeah, it's working. Boom. Yeah, okay. Because we had the reactive targets.
Back to that story of me shooting for the first time. I was loaded up a 22 rifle, and this was probably one of the older ones that had longer. Nowadays, you can't really get a 22 rifle with, you know, much more than a 16 inch barrel. But these ones probably had like, you know, 19 or 20 inch barrels, and we were shooting, you know, standard velocity 22 out of them. And I was like, man, this isn't making much noise. And I was wearing, you know, earmuffs, and I kind of slid it a little bit off my ear and pulled the trigger. And I'm like, yeah, no, that's not making much noise. Then tucked them around my neck and like, oh yeah, no, the, you know, a standard pressure out of a 22-inch barrel at 22 subsonic is 100% hearing safe. It's essentially suppressed. So I'm shooting this and I'm like, oh man, that's no big deal. And then my buddy pulled out an H&R 22 revolver and was sticking those exact same shells into it. And I'm like, okay, this is going to make a lot of noise either. And then he touched that first one off and I just went, oh, hold on. He goes, oh, I didn't realize you weren't ready. And I'm like, I thought I was. Barrel length makes a huge difference.
Oh, yeah. I don't remember what this was. I think it was a shotgun. Somebody made a shotgun with just a ridiculously long barrel. Ridiculously long. Like, I want to say like 3 feet or so. And they effectively suppressed it without using suppressor baffles just by the length of the barrel.
Yep.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think I vaguely remember hearing about that that shotgun, but I mean, that's essentially all you need to do is, you know, when you're firing a round, it's the pressure is still building, but eventually you're going to have enough that all the gunpowder is going to get consumed, and now the rounds are going to be slowing down inside the barrel, and the pressure is going to be dissipating, and eventually, on a long enough timeline, the rounds are going to drop out the end, and it's going to be, yeah, there's not going to be any sound. Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcalibers podcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, and the new ACP film tracks, ACP mag dump, and our CRKT knife giveaway. You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
Well, I am rapidly becoming the queen of all media because you can find me on Facebook. You can find me at lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com, bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com, operationblazingsword.org, and pinkpistols.org.
Thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
He's the podcast bicycle, and I run not one, but two pro-gun charities. Our Second Amendment advocacy is assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.